WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with part two of our interview with Ringo Starr. You can see him later this month, reunited with Paul McCartney and George Harrison on a three-part Beatles documentary that will be broadcast on ABC TV. When I spoke with Ringo last June, we talked about the early days of the Beatles. Here's an early song featured on the recent CD, The Beatles Live at the BBC. So how did the Beatles ask you to join the band after they asked Pete Best to leave it?
Well, they didn't do it that way. You see, Pete Best was still in the band, and I was with Rory.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Pete couldn't make the session, so they asked me to play. And we'd got to know each other in Germany because we were the two bands playing there, the Beatles and Rory Storm. So, you know, we really became friends there. Then we kept back to Liverpool, and Pete couldn't make it one day, and Brian Epstein came and said, would you play the lunchtime session? And I said, sure. And that was it. And then we went for a drink, and that was the end of the story. And then a couple of weeks later, he asked me again to play a couple of sessions, a couple of gigs. And I said, sure, you know, because I just happened to have the time. And then I went away to play with Rory to a... It's a holiday camp in England, Butlin's Holiday Camp, where you go for 3 months, you play the summer there in the Rock and Calypso Hall, and we were the rock band, and Brian called me on the phone, and he said, you know, would you like to join the Beatles? Well, I said, sure, I'd love to join the Beatles, and I said, when? And he said, today. And I said, well, I can't join today. That was a Wednesday in 1962, and I said, I can't play today because, you know, the band would be out of a job. We'd have to wait till Saturday because... by then, we could get another drummer. And that's what happened. And, you know, everybody knows the story from then on.
Well, an interesting part of the story is that you showed up for the first recording session.
Oh, yeah.
Of the Beatles. And the producer...
George Martin.
Yeah, had another drummer all picked out. Because I guess he didn't know that you had been chosen to be in the band.
No, he didn't know. Well, he listened to the band with Pete Best and didn't think Pete... was going to be on the session, and so he didn't know about me at all. And so he'd got this drummer, Andy White, ready, a professional drummer, a session drummer. And I came down, and I was just mortified. And he said, oh, we've got this real drummer here. I thought, what am I? And he didn't want to take a chance, because in those days, it wasn't like you could go in the studio and just spend your time there. You know, the session was 3 hours. You were in and out. And that was it. So Andy played on the single, and of course, then we re-recorded it, and I played on the album. And I sort of defy anyone to tell the difference. And that was it. But George Martin has apologized over and over again because I've made him for doing this to me.
Yes, actually, I think he continues the apologies in his new book.
I think he does. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he did on Friday when I was with him.
Oh.
So I always remind him.
Well, what did you think the Beatles' chances were of really making it? What was your assessment of the band when you joined it?
I joined the band because they were the best band I'd heard. And that was how I played. I moved my career through Liverpool, of course, to, you know, if I could get into a better band, I would. And that's how I did it. You know, my aim was to play with good players. And that's what I did. I mean, the aim was not really to, you know, be big and famous. It was just to play with really good people.
Did you change your sound when you joined the Beatles?
No. That's why they, they wanted me to play, because of the way I could play.
So when you joined the band, did you have to do, you know, the Beatles haircut and the suit jacket?
Well, that's the famous line. You know, John came on the phone saying, "Welcome to the band, but you'll have to get your hair cut and get rid of your beard." and which I did. I didn't have much of a beard then, but I did have my hair swept back. And we had it cut so it fell forward. It was part of the image, and Brian Epstein was moving them into like this image thing too, making them wear suits and, you know, not drinking and smoking on stage. So it was all part of the deal.
Did that come easy for you? Were you comfortable with that? Or?
Oh, yeah, because I'd been in a group that had suits. You know, Rory, Storm and the Hurricane, we were the top band in Liverpool because we had suits. And, you know, everyone else was just in, like they are now, actually, all sort of scruffed up. But we were professionals. So, you know, it's all funny to think about it now, but that red suit meant so much.
Red, wow.
Red, and we had green suits, so we could change. Big doings in the 60s, I'll tell you, big doings.
No, in the Beatles, did you have to, like, figure out who you were going to be in terms of your public personality in the band? Because everybody in the band seemed to get this, you know, public persona.
Yeah, I think mine just came in naturally as Mr. Dopey. You know, it's sort of like the comic clown, you know? John had their edge. Paul was Mr. Lovable. Well, I was Mr. Lovable, but the young girls loved him. George was this silent type, and, you know, I was, hi, what's happening? And so that image, of course, especially through Hard Day's Night, is, you know, I've had to battle that since that day. Everybody thinks, oh, that's what he's like. And, of course, he's not like that at all.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like early on when the Beatles' fame started getting, like, so extraordinary that you couldn't go places without attracting crowds? I mean,
well, you know, we were young boys, and it was exciting where we, you know, we sort of conquered England. That was the first job, you know, just to get down to London and get in there was heavy enough. And then we'd do the continent. You know, we used to have this saying, oh, well, we've done Sweden, we've conquered Sweden, we've done France now, we've done Italy, you know. And then, of course, we were invited to come to America. And at that time, we were really worried because we'd had two records out here, or they were coming out. Nobody wanted them. And by chance, George came over for a holiday. He was the first one of us to come to America. And of course, he was going into record shops saying, oh, have you got the Beatles? And they were saying, excuse me, never heard of them. So, you know, he came back saying, oh, they don't know us over there. And of course, you know, the story goes when Capitol decided to put some money behind us to promote us, and we got off the plane to do Ed Sullivan. We had a number one. I mean, you know, you can't plan things like that. This is just how it is.
Well, the first Ed Sullivan performance is one of the watershed moments in rock and roll history. What are some of your memories of
Ed Sullivan?
Of that show?
Well,
yeah.
Ed, you see, I thought we come to America and it was fabulous, and there was millions of people at the airport, and there were lying in the streets, and it was yeah all over the place. And just my mind I have of Ed to this day, and I don't know if it's actually true, but my impression was Ed Sullivan, you know, I'm waiting for Ed to say, you know, they are, they're all the way from England and it's great and they're going to be fabulous and blah 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 blah, and it's like Ed said, here they are, the Beatles.
Well, you probably couldn't
just
comprehend,
like, thrown,
the whole, yeah,
thrown to the lions. Right. So to this day, I've always thought, God, I mean, we could have done better than that, Ed.
Well, you probably were unfamiliar with the whole Ed Sullivan phenomenon. I mean, the most
we didn't know what it meant.
Square person.
You know, we did not know what it meant. You know, this guy just booked us on a show, and we'd go anywhere for a gig.
So when girls started screaming at your performances, did you have any idea what was going on? Like why the screaming as opposed to anything else?
It started in Liverpool, and just.
So you actually knew where it started.
Oh, I mean, it caught on like wildfire all over the world.
Was it frustrating to perform in concerts where you couldn't hear what you were playing because the audience was screaming so loudly?
It got frustrating in the end. At the beginning, it was just fabulous. I mean, you know, if you can imagine you're 22, 23, and you go on stage, and all those people are just screaming at you, loving you. I mean, you know, you were making a lot of records and making good records. You know, it was everything you dreamed of. And it just built up and built up. And, of course, around about 65, you know, it started actually to get a little tiring because, you know, we were starting to make really interesting records and we couldn't perform them. And it didn't matter what we did, people were screaming anyway, so no one was listening. And because of that, we were becoming, you know, not the best musicians we would become because we could only play you know, the actual thing. I mean, for me personally, I, you know, it's very hard to do this on radio, but I could only do the downbeat, you know, check, 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 check. I couldn't do any fills or anything because they would just disappear into the, you know, into the cosmos. So you found yourself, you know, you're just sitting there playing the track, really.
Ringo Starr is my guest. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with my guest, Ringo Starr. Do you have a favorite phase of the Beatles' recording years?
I think, well, you see, the very first record, you know, making the first records was just a thrill. I mean, it was absolutely thrilling. And listening to it on the radio, you know, we would stop the car when we'd be going to a gig somewhere, and you'd know, you know, because they didn't play them every 10 minutes. Oh, it's 7:45 on Wednesday, they're going to play your record. And so wherever we were going, we'd stop the car. We're usually in a car, and listen to it. And the other thing we did, if it moved up the charts, we would always have a celebratory dinner. So if you look at Beatle photos and Beatle footage, you'd see them getting fatter and fatter and fatter as they were getting more popular, because now we could afford food, you know. But and then, of course, from Rubber Soul on, you know, the record started to really get exciting. Or, you know, the sound, we were really getting into the sound, making sounds, making good sounds. The writing was getting better. You know, everything was picking up. It was really getting good. So, you know, it had a natural progression. So, you know, to say this period or that period, they're all different periods. I mean, I like the White Album. That's one of my favorites, just because it, I felt after Sgt. Pepper, which was brilliant, but it just doesn't happen to be my favorite. The White Album, we were getting back to being a band again. And, you know, that's what the Beatles were. We were a really cool band.
Being a band as opposed to being artfully produced in the studio? Is that
sure,
what you mean?
Even though we did it ourselves, you know, suddenly the... So the strings and the brass were taking the center stage around the songs instead of the group.
Is there a track that you like best for your own work? I'd like...
Well, if you want to play an early Beatle track, you can always play Rain.
Well, why don't we do that?
Why not?
My guest is Ringo Starr. It's something else about the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were such an important part of music,
life.
Period, you know. And they're really a very small part in your life. I mean, a big part in who you are, but a small
sure.
part in the number of years
sure.
that you were a Beatle.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd like to get a sense of what it means in your life if you still feel... like that is so much a part of your existence, or if that's something that you've really tried to move beyond and away from. And
well, I don't think you can move away from it, because it, you know, it was only 8 years of my life, but it's the 8 years that everybody really associates with. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't matter, I've made hit records and you know, I had hit albums and I'm on tour and that. It always comes back to these 8 years of being a Beatle. And I think I just have to resign myself to that's what people want to know about. But, of course, in my life, I've moved on, you know. I've done other things. You know, Barbara and I have been together for 15 years. You know, been married 14. So, you know, the love of my life, who's here with me today, listeners, you know, we have our life, we live together, but, you know, whenever it comes down to something like this, it's always a Beatle program.
Did you want the group to break up? Were you ready for it?
I think we were all ready in a way, because it wasn't as much fun as it used to be. It was okay while we got in the studio for a while, and then, you know, there would be some bickering. And nobody wanted to put in the time, including myself. You know, no one wanted to put in the time and energy that it took later on. You know, we may have done the first album in 12 hours, but the last ones were taking months. And, you know, no one really wanted to put in that time and energy. So it was sort of just like a natural falling apart, really.
I know you've been sober since 1988.
Mm-hmm. I am still sober today.
Did you have alcohol or drug problems for much of your career before that?
Well, it didn't seem to be a problem in those days. Though, you know, you're younger and you can recoup real easy. And it, you know, I did use and abuse even in those days, but it wasn't on a daily basis. It just sort of caught up with me from sort of 1975, I believe. That's where my real downhill roll started. And, you know, it just got faster and faster and worse, and, you know, blackouts and passouts. And found yourself, you couldn't really handle the day unless you had something change in your attitude, you know, alcohol or drugs of any description. And in the end, it just got so scary and painful and frightening that, you know, I hit my bottom just terrified, and just, you know, God's will and Barbara's got us into a rehab, because I didn't know you did that. And but I was frightened enough to ask, you better get us in one of those places. And that's what she did. And from since then, you know, thanks to them, thanks be to God, I haven't had a drug or a drink on a daily basis.
I know your son plays with you in your band.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, like, watch him when
Yeah,
when
I watch
you're on
him. Watch his every move, the little whippersnapper. No, it's, I don't watch him. He's a really fabulous player. And what is just exciting, it's like, you know, I'm not looking at him all the time, but I just turn around and look over, and there he is. And you've got your son. I mean, it's just an absolute thrill that he's up there with you, you know. And it just goes to prove that, you know, you give him one lesson and watch out. They're up there with you.
So he plays
drums.
So he plays your instrument.
Yeah, and my.
Are you flattered that he plays the same instrument you do? You know, some kids will do anything.
Well,
anything to not do what their parents did.
Sure. No, he's always been a drummer since he was a baby. He's always been a drummer, but he also plays good piano and good guitar. But the interesting thing with our family is he plays drums, and so does his brother, who's another drummer. So we are the family drummers, you know.
Ringo Starr, recorded last June. The documentary, The Beatles Anthology, will be broadcast over 3 nights on ABC TV beginning November 19th. This is Fresh Air.